This recording is from Hadar's first queer colloquium, a day of learning for alumni that celebrated Torah informed by the lens of queer experience, that Hadar held in New York on Sunday, October 27th.
My name is Rabbi Avi Strasberg. I'm on faculty with Hadar. I am based full-time in DC, but I have the honor of getting to be here in New York to help organize this program. And I just want to start with a moment of really deep gratitude for everyone that is in the room right now, queer folks, allies, who has made it a point on a Sunday afternoon to be in this Beit Midrash amidst the torrents of pouring rain. And so I'm really thankful to all of you that you are filling this space. There would be no colloquium had you not shown up today on the Sunday. Tanu Rabbanan, Haro'eh Ochlosei Yisrael, Omer Baruch Hacham Harazim, She'ein Da'atam Domeh Zelaze, Ve'ein Partufehem Domim Zelaze. So it was taught, the one who sees a large amount of Jews, of B'nai Yisrael, should say, Baruch Hacham Harazim, blessed is the wise one, the knower of secrets, because each one, all of these people gathered in one space, their minds, their da'atam, are not similar one to the other, and their partufehem, their faces, are not similar one to the other. So I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the beautiful diversity of people that is in this room right now. We have people who are queer identified, and we have people who are allies. We have folks with a diverse and amazing array of gender identities, trans folks, gender non-conforming folks, non-binary people, and cis people. People for whom the questions and conversations that we'll dive into today are a daily part of life, and people who may be encountering some of these ideas for the first time. I have two hopes and a request for you. My first hope is that for all of us, this can be an afternoon of deep listening and of deep learning. My second hope is that we'll each learn something today that surprises us, that resonates with us, that challenges us, and that leaves us with a question. And my request is that we are generous with each other and that we are gentle with each other. The questions we are asking today go to the heart of identity, of vulnerability, and what it means to be a religious Jew. In our learning today and in the future around these questions, we may stumble and make mistakes, but that we are here today because we care about creating a tradition that is inclusive of the beautiful diversity of this room, and because we specifically care about this particular community. I also want to express my deep gratitude to Lainey Solomon, who is in the back. Lainey has really been my core partner in this program. It arose out of a conversation after our alumni Shabbaton, where we had our first ever queer caucus of our alumni on a Shabbat afternoon during free time, when 50, 60 of us gathered together to talk about both to revel in and to celebrate the growing queer community of alumni at Hadar, and to ask the question, what can we and what should we be doing together? And following that Shabbaton, Lainey and I got together, and Lainey said, wouldn't it be so amazing if we had a queer colloquium? The language is totally Lainey's. What if we had a day of learning? And so I just really want to acknowledge Lainey's very significant role in helping me bring this to fruition. There are four goals of this colloquium. We're ambitious. The first one is simply we want to lift up queer voices. All the people teaching today and our panelists, in however the language that they use that feels comfortable, identify in some way as queer. And this is an opportunity to lift up those voices. Second, we want to encourage the creation of new Torah informed through the lens of queer experience. We want to get that Torah out into the world. Third, we see this as an opportunity to learn from and with each other, to ask questions, to be challenged, and to grow in our understanding of Torah and each other. And fourth, this is an opportunity to ask a number of important questions. What can we do together? What is the Torah that we need to bring into this world, and how might it be informed by our queer perspectives? What are the questions we need to be asking and the next steps in doing this work together? and how can we support each other in this work? But before we can talk about that work, before we can share in each other's Torah and lift up each other's voices, we want to take the time to lift up the Torah of the people who allowed us to get to where we are today. I want to express my deep gratitude to our panelists today and the generations of leaders who have been doing this work before us. We open with the sage's words that when one sees a multitude, when one sees a diversity of people, one should say, Baruch Chacham Harazim, blessed is the wise one, the knower of secrets. Recognizing the diversity in the hiddenness of our hearts, and in that each heart is different from the next. The Gemara Masechet Brachot continues to say that once Ben Zoma stood on the Temple Mount, and Ben Zoma saw a multitude and said, Baruch Chacham Harazim, Baruch Shebara Kol Elu L'Shem Sheni, blessed is the knower of secrets, blessed is the one who created all of these to serve me. Why did Ben Zoma say that when he looked out upon the multitude? The Gemara goes on to explain. He would say, how much effort did Adam HaRishon, did the first man exert before he found bread to eat? He would plow, he would sow, reap, he would sheave, thresh, winnow, separate the grain from the chaff, ground the grain into flour, sifted, kneaded, and baked, and only after that could he eat. And I, on the other hand, I wake up and I find all of these prepared before me. And how much effort did Adam HaRishon exert before he found a garment to wear? He sheared and he laundered, he combed and spun and wove. And only after that he found garments to wear. And I wake up and I find all of these prepared before me. Each of our panelists, Rabbi Sara Lev, Rabbi Emilia Aviva, Kaper Mater, and Rabbi Steven Greenberg, have plowed, they have sowed, they have reaped, and they have winnowed, so that we could be here today and have the ability to be having these conversations about what's next. Rabbi Steven Greenberg, for founding the Jerusalem Open House, Jerusalem First Gay and Lesbian Community Center, and for founding Eshel, an Orthodox LGBT community support, education, and advocacy organization, I thank you. Rabbi Emily Aviva Kaper Mater, for your innovative work creating liturgy and ritual for transgender Jews that is rooted in halakha, I thank you. For Rabbi Sara Lev, for the many, many Talmud classes you teach, all of which you attempt to push back at the text through a queer feminist lens, I thank you. Before we do the work of lifting up our alumni voices and asking what's the next steps for our community, we want to turn to each of you as leaders who have been asking many of these same questions for years. Just a note on format, I'm going to ask a few questions. I'll ask that our dear panelists who have so many thoughts to say, try to keep their answers to a few minutes so that we're able to hear a few questions. And also ambitiously, I'm gonna hold 10 minutes at the end so that we could take at least one round of questions to also hear your voice so you can be thinking of those questions. Okay, I gave brief bios of your work, but all of you are here because you have done so much more than that and contributed so much more than that. So I want to ask you, as we call this an event about queer Torah, I want to begin by asking you the question, what does queer Torah mean to you? And how has this informed, how does this relate to the work that you're doing in the world? And we'll start with Rabbi Sara Lev.
So, hi everyone, thank you for having me. It's really amazing to see this many queer people that I don't know in one room. I want to reframe from queer Torah to queering Torah, because when I think about what I do, I think of it as not as finding the queer in Torah or the queer parts of Torah, but as actually taking Torah and looking at it through a queer lens, doing what queer people or what queer theory does with Torah. And so I think about it in some ways as the early, I teach Talmud, so those are my guys. And what I think about is that the way that they understood their responsibility to Torah was to make that which is invisible, visible. To write through Midrash, they would look at Torah and they would, as opposed to giving us the pshat of Torah, they would give us what the secrets of Torah, right? They would look at it and say, what is it that we're looking at here that's hinting at that there's something else going on? And so when I think about Torah, I think about it as responsibility. And when I think about queering, I think about it as responsibility. The responsibility to make those who are invisible, visible. So it's that it's the same act that we're doing that they did, but it's just doing it from our stance. And so I guess for me that where that places us is with a huge amount of responsibility and also with a huge amount of curiosity and the ability to read in new and different ways than we've previously been taught to read. If I can throw out the name of one of my favorite queer theorists is Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick, who talks about paranoid reading and reparative reading. And she talks about how what we do as a community is paranoid reading in the best of senses, but also in the most limited of senses. And she says that what we need to do is to open up ways of reading. And so I think that queering is about opening up those ways of reading and finding ways to repair, not to apologize for, but to repair the text that is before us, and to be in relationship with that text. So I think that.
I'll yeah, thank you, Rabbi Goodman. Pass it to feel free to respond.
So I think Saralev and I are similar in our approaches. So founding Eshel meant that kind of thinking about how to address the larger question of teaching Torah to very disparate groups. So it's like teaching to the Orthodox community, but teaching then to queer Jews, teaching to genderqueer Jews, teaching to trans Jews. And the son realized that the aims of teaching have to be incredibly broad to put all those people in the same Beit Midrash safely and thoughtfully. So I want to begin by saying, telling a story about how, like the challenge of this, topic of queer Torah. So I was once asked, before I was even out, I think I must have been like in my 20s, I was in rabbinical school in Camp Stone, and Bnei Akiva camp asked me to come for the summer and teach social justice texts to the campers. And when I had this conversation with the lead educator, he said, well, you're going to teach socialism mina Torah, right? And I said, well, yeah, as long as like the next day I can teach capitalism mina Torah. Like, it's like fine. But so I have an allergy to lenses that end up becoming a kind of frame for mirroring. Like we look for what we want and we see it. But then are we actually learning? So speaking for myself, I'm nervous about the idea if there's such a thing as queer Torah. That doesn't mean that I haven't noticed the same common themes. Like, I think that we like edgier, less conventional Torah. And the reason is because convention has read us out so often. We like the hermeneutic tension, as you've mentioned, Saralev, as well, between the revealed and the hidden, because so many of us have been hiding for so long. We thrive on the survival of the dat yachid, of the marginal voices, because we've been marginalized. And the fact that they're not immediately excluded from discourse is incredibly joyous, just to find them. But while we all love a mirror, because we felt invisible, and because we all need, particularly those of us who, in engaging with this material, have felt ignored or maligned or even demonized by it, to find pieces of ourselves reflected in it in kind of exciting or interesting or thoughtful ways is incredibly redemptive. However, authentic learning, and this is my ambivalence, is not is discovery, not self-confirmation. And real relationship means that you're not wholly in charge. And it means that you're going to be surprised and not always happily. It means that you engage in a process that takes the text seriously rather than a means for self-confirmation, but a means for growth and engagement and struggle and sometimes pain. You don't go into a relationship with the guarantee you will not suffer. And anyone who tries to do that will recognize that they are not in a relationship. So, but how do we actually do this? Like, so I want to say, yes, I like teaching the Benot Slavchad. I like teaching the tailor who challenges, Daniel the tailor who challenges the rabbi's assumptions. I like teaching the androgynous, Adam, the Dupar Tzufim. I like teaching the naked story of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in the Jordan River. I like teaching the serial outing in the book of, in Megillat Esther. There's certain things I love doing, but I'm not exactly sure if that makes these texts queer. I know it makes me queer. I have 160 texts in my book that I quote and use in various frames, and to be honest, some of them I found totally obliquely. You would have never thought of them as queer texts when you opened them up. And some of the most interesting discoveries came from leaning into difficult texts and not looking for queer texts, in fact. And actually looking for the texts that are most challenging to queer identity and discovering in them something that was hidden that I didn't see before. So perhaps the most queer, resource is the very polysemy of our tradition. The fact that Jewish reading is never done and it's always opens up new windows once you've finished learning. We trust that the revelation of the scripture is real and alive because we read it closely and carefully. We don't lie about it, and we read it as ourselves. And we read it in the present. Hayom im bekolot yishmo. It's read today. And that's what Chazal did, and it's what we do. And indeed, that very ability to see the text as open yet for another legitimate human reading of another generation is what actually the Chidushi Harim, Rav Yitzhak Meir Rotenberg Alter, the first Ger Rebbe, wrote on Ha'azinu just recently. He didn't write it recently, but we read it. I read it recently. Zechor Yimotolam Binu Shnot Dor Vador Shalavicha V'Yagedcha Zikenecha V'Yomrulach in Dvarim Lamed Bet Yud Zayin. Each new year, says the Chidushi Harim, each new year. The interpretation of the Torah comes into being. A new one comes into being. In every generation and in every period, a new insight into the Torah descends from the heavens, suited to that generation. And the righteous of each generation perceive in the Torah that which is needed to instruct that generation. This generation, this room, is reading this year's Chidushei Torah. And that is queer.
If I can bounce on something that you said, I think, going off from what he says in Ha'azinu, the very next bit of Ha'azinu, which I think is what this is leading into, is where Moshe refers to the generation that left Mitzrayim and then died in the Midbar as the Dor Tahapuchos, how would you translate the upside down generation, and Dor Tahapuchos
outing yourself.
I have to switch my brain again. Is the name of a sefer that was written on trans halakha and trans halakhic issues in Israel, and it's not normative in a lot of parts of Orthodoxy, but it is it's a lot further along in a lot of places than one might expect. I mean, it's not in some other ones that I have serious issues with some of the reasoning that he takes to get to where he gets to, but so I think this is very interesting when you say that this is the upside down generation. I mean, that's the whole conceit of the book is saying why it's called that. And it's a very controversial sort of idea that this is something new. And in one respect, it isn't. It isn't anything new. But in one respect, it really is, and we do have to acknowledge that. We can, as Rabbi Greenberg was saying, we can look for ourselves in these old texts, and we can look for things that sort of point the way to us. But in my view, it's a mistake to read ourselves back in. As we are right now, and instead of, which isn't to say that you shouldn't take the ancient texts and the Talmud and codes and so forth at anything other than face value. I mean, even they didn't take it at face value. The people who were writing it. I think there's something that I want to highlight is there's a funny sort of pushback that's happened in liberal Judaism writ large and queer Judaism writ small over the last number of decades, which is a pushback against this idea of Yiridat HaDorot, that the further we get away from Har Sinai, the further from Hashem we are, the further we are from the source of truth. And there's a funny pushback that's happened to that, whereby going back to Torah and back to, you know, Nach and back to Gemara, there's been a sort of attempt to reclaim some of that for ourselves. And on the one hand, this is a very good thing. And on the other hand, I think we risk losing a tremendous amount from the history that happened 1,500 years after the Gemara, from the Rishonim and the Acharonim and the codes especially. I'm not really a text person. I'm a halacha person. I'm a halacha lamasa person. I'm much more concerned with how things turn out in the real world than with how they turn out in theory. And what's funny to me about the way that queer issues and trans issues and so forth are being taught and being studied, and the way we look for ourselves in these texts, is that it doesn't have a perfect resonance for me. What I want to see is myself in responsa literature. I want to see myself in codes. I want to see myself in the world as it is now, not the world as we sort of imagine it to have been 2,000 years ago. And that's where we start running into real problems, because, you know, we can argue until, you know, I will argue happily with anyone until the moon goes blue from cold about how many genders are in the Mishnah. It's, you know, I will argue until I'm blue in the face that there's really only two. There's men and everyone else. There's six genders in the Mishnah, and that proves that Judaism is queer accepting. Well, you know, it's, I mean, that works on Tumblr, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the world of people who want, for lack of a better phrase, to be taken seriously by the heteronormative, cisnormative establishment, which is where we are at this time. And I wish it weren't so, but that's where we are at this time. It's something else that I absolutely have to mention, which is something going back to what Rabbi Sarlov said a few minutes ago about making the invisible visible, is doing a little bit of careful separation of trans issues from queer issues. They're related, but not completely. And along with that, bringing in and lifting up trans issues and so forth that intersect with other marginalizations and issues of justice, racial issues and disability issues are things that are very important to me as well. And making the invisible visible is something that we have to do from our place as educators, our place as rabbis, rabbinical students, cantors, clergy, that sort of thing. making sure that we are able to lift up those voices and yet acknowledge that the issues that everyone is bringing to the table are going to be different and the solutions might need to be different as well.
I want to thank each of you already for beginning to open up. We're beginning to open up what queer Torah might mean. And I also want to highlight that as part of your registration for this event, many of you submitted definitions of what queer Torah might mean or could mean. And I just, in your time in the space today, there's a few of them up here and many of them downstairs, is that we are excited to. I'm excited about the ways that you are expanding and pushing back and challenging even the very language of queer Torah, and to see even amongst this room what the different ideas that you're bringing to this conversation. Rabbi Greenberg, you mentioned when you were speaking that part of when we approach the text, we have to approach it with honesty and be prepared that sometimes the text is going to disappoint us, or we're not going to like what we find in there. And I'd love to throw that question back to you, back to our other panelists. What do you do emotionally, spiritually, theologically when you go back to Torah? And that there's things in Torah that let you down, or language in Torah that lets you down. How do you go from there? And I'll let, yeah, it's like early stars.
What you said resonated with me a lot, and actually was a lot of what I actually wrote down as an answer to that question. I tell my students when I start teaching them a story about Aryan Nation. Just to make things interesting. So the story goes that when my chavruta and I started to learn Talmud together for my PhD, he looked up online Talmud on Google, and the first 10 sites that came up were Aryan Nation. And what Aryan Nation does is they take little quotes from Talmud and they say, this is what the Talmud says, and they're true. I mean, it's real quotes from the Talmud. They're usually from the Sansino version, which makes them very hard to understand. But what I tell my students is that rabbis do the same thing. They just do the other quotes, right? They're cutting and pasting just the same way that Aryan Nation is cutting and pasting, and that what I expect from them is that they look at the entire text, not the things they like, but the whole of it, the things they don't like, the icky parts. And in fact, for many years, I taught them Sota as the first text that they learned, just so that they would see what's really in there. I guess what I want to say is I don't expect my partner to always think the same things that I do. I don't expect my friends to always think the same things that I do. And the way that I learn and grow and push the boundaries is when I come up against those things that they disagree with. And therefore, I don't expect Torah to say the same things that I do either. And that I think that for me, holiness is the process of confronting those edges, confronting the stuff that I don't like. So I think, when it says, Kadoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani, you should be holy because I am holy, that's a command. That's not a statement of fact. And that command means, push against the edges. It means, like, learn stuff, grow. I think the same thing that Steve was saying, that what Torah's not about telling us what we should be, it's telling us what is. And it's giving us the opportunity to engage with what is in order to make what should be. That's kind of how I think about the process.
Do you want to respond first so we don't have to go in order?
Sure. I would say to this that we don't have to require perfection of the text. Midrash is the process of fixing the imperfections of the text, and part of what I was saying earlier about this idea of Yiridat HaDorot is that the canon of Midrash is more or less unspokenly taken to be closed now. I heard a fantastic new Midrash Halakha a couple of weeks ago on a particular aspect of something very, very esoteric about lulav and etrog. It's not very important what it is, but the whole point was it was a very new close reading of a Torah text to elucidate a halachic point, which is something that we sort of think ended in, you know, Talmudic literature in the Gemara. And then we've sort of been doing the same process on the Gemara text now and saying, like, well, why did Rabbi so-and-so say this word instead of that word? And it's, well, you know, even more so than the human, than the Torah, the Gemara was written in human language. So I'm not sure that it's fair to subject it to that kind of analysis. But I also want to push back just a little bit about what you were saying and say that part of being a religious Jew, at least for me, I mean, other people are going to get mileage out of this in different ways, and this is going to be a controversial statement, but part of being a religious Jew for me means subordinating part of myself to what I understand to be the will of Kadosh Baruch Hu, and to what I understand to be the many faces of Torah are not there so that I can pick the one that I want. They're there so that I can look at all of them and say these are all different ways to understanding how the Ribbono Shel Olam wants me to live my life and how I want to, the kind of society that I want to build, the kind of Torah that I want to go out and teach. So I'm not 100% comfortable with looking at the text purely academically, because as a religious Jew, I can't do that. I mean, as an academic, I can do that, and I can be perfectly comfortable with, you know, something like the documentary hypothesis as an academic. But then when you look at the text from the perspective of a religious Jew, you're still left with the initial question: what are you going to do about it? What's the nafka mina of how we look? I mean, this is getting a little musudik, but yes, you have to be willing to subordinate yourself to the Torah just a little bit, just a little bit, because to do otherwise, in my mind, is the very height of human arrogance. So I'm curious where you come down on that.
So I didn't intend to kind of go in this direction, but I think I will now. So look, this is not the only, like, you know, Leviticus 18, for instance, is not the only problem I might have in reading scripture. So I kind of think, like, you know, we read texts that challenge us in lots of different ways. On the other hand, it's not a consumer good where I buy it if I like it, I reject it if I don't. There was once this installation of a whole Torah opened up with lines whited out or etched out. And I kind of thought, like, no one is going to read that Torah. And it ends up, again, becoming a mirror rather than, like, a backdrop against which we have real conversations with ourselves, with the Holy One, in community, with the Torah itself. So, however, I do think that there's a tradition of protest. And the tradition, have any of you opened up Dov Weiss's book recently published, something called Pious, I don't remember the title right now, it's in my head, but it's Pious Resistance to God, Pious, like, Rebellion Against, huh?
Pious Irreverence.
Pious, that's, thank you. That's, yeah. See, there you go, Pious Irreverence. And he basically documents that some willingness of the tradition to put resistance. You find it in the Torah itself with Abraham, you find it in Moshe, but you also find it in the Hebraic literature and less in the Tannaitic literature, but in post-Amoraic literature, particularly in the Tanhuma Yilamdenu, there's a deep tradition of the legitimacy of holding God accountable for failure. So I guess what I want to claim is that there's the dance that we all do with this, which is trying to retain trust in the Holy Word and our commitment to a fantasy of blessing and goodness that we are covenantally bound to provide the families of the earth with, shehi chochmatchem be'enei agoyim, that somehow what we do and what we think are going to be seen as wise in the courts and in the universities all over the world. On some level, we cannot stand aside from our own history of critique, and we need to be able to sustain it with love and with fealty. So I think this is really, in a way, this question is at the key, forgive me for being grandiose here, but it's what's happening in the country. Is America, as the 1619 insert in the New York Times demonstrated, basically the product of a racist, white supremacist idea covered over by a constitution that failed? So I think that view of America leaves all of us bereft of value, vision, hope, and work. And so on some level, what do we do to retain a sense of pride in this nation and its values and its constitution and its founding fathers, while knowing that it began in imperfection and trouble, and that some in part was fixed and still needs to be fixed? So can we, that is the task. The task is to be piously, truly piously irreverent. And I think we've done it. I think that we probably are the cultural resource most able to take our religious experience and be a gift to this moment in America and maybe even in human history. Specifically on this point, you do not need to trash old texts that disappoint you. You need to find out how you love them and engage them in ways that amount to more or less an amendment history that evolves. So I think that's my response is, there are multiple ways of doing it. Chazal had one way. If you read the story of Daniel the tailor, which I mentioned, it's this amazing story. I'm sure you've all heard it. A tailor sitting in the back of the Beit Midrash in Pupadita, and he hears the rabbis in the fourth parak of Kohelet, Ra'iti et Ashukim, and I saw the oppressed, and they're terrible, and no one cares about them, and they have no hope, and their oppressors have power, and no one to comfort them. And Daniel the tailor, a nobody, gets up and says, those are the mamzerim who have done nothing wrong, and who have no power, and the people who have power are the rabbis who deprive them of marrying into the congregation. Marriage is the issue again, being alone in the world. And basically, he accuses the rabbis of being oppressors. Now, this is not the question. This text is beautiful, but that's not the question. The rabbis codified that narrative into the canon. That is the mystery. You codify into the canon the resistance to the perfection of your project, and then the project can survive, I think, well into the future.
Thank you to each of you. We have 15 minutes left. So I have two questions that I want to throw out, and then I'll let you, you don't all need to speak to both of them, but speak to if there's one that calls to you. One question I wanted to ask is, how do you feel like your own perspectives and identities as a queer person, and I want to give that to you in the language however you identify, along with your other identities, has shaped you as a teacher, as a theologian, or as a rabbi? How have your own perspectives shaped you as a rabbi and the thinker that you are? My second question that I would love to hear is, where do you think we go next? What are the questions? What are the questions that we need to be asking? What is the work we need to be doing? And what are the tools that we have at our disposal to do this work? Yes, and one more.
I feel like I can't ask a question because we came late, but I'm just going to put it out there. See if it's come on. You know, maybe it was already asked or something. And I'm not necessarily looking for like a condemnation or a support, more just reflection on the recent YCT incident with ordination. I think there's been I perceive personally a pretty big generational split in like in the way people interpret it. And sometimes a regional split even, which I find very interesting. Mm-hmm. Israel versus New York versus the West Coast. So it just reflections on that and it's a sensitive topic that I think people are thinking about.
Thank you. Was there any other question that came up for anyone? Okay. Amazing. So you have now 11 minutes. If there's a question that you heard that you want to speak to, that would be great. And we'll start with whoever feels called.
Well, I can give you an al-ragel achat answer to your question about YCT, which is that my al-ragel achat answer is they're perfectly free to do whatever they want as an institution, and I'm perfectly free to think what I want about that. Do I think it was a mistake? Yeah. Do I think it was understandable? I don't know. It's very uncomfortable. I will say there's a lot to the story that did not make it into the national Jewish press. Not the Jewish press. You know what I mean. You know what I mean. The Jewish media. Lahavdil. Yeah. But I mean, yeah. Is that kind of thing going to start happening more and more? I can only pray that it does, because that's going to throw the conflict into even sharper relief. I pray that it happens. As bloodlessly and painlessly as possible, but it is going to keep happening. And from the perspective of someone of my generation, you know, one of these millennials who's killing everything and, you know, ruining everything for the rest of the world, I can tell you that it's not going to stop. There's going to be another incident, another incident like that, and you're gonna end up with what Rabbi B'nai Lapi calls a crash. We're already there, and so that's interesting. To what you were saying, your question about how does my identity shape the Torah that I do? I mean, it can't help but be otherwise. It can't. I'm not sure what the question means, because I don't know what it's like to teach Torah as a non-trans person. I don't know what it's like to daven, you know, without the, like in a synagogue without this sense of this deep-seated fear that I don't belong there somehow. Mm-hmm. Even in an egalitarian mechitza-less synagogue, I still have this sense of, well, maybe, you know, this isn't for people like me. So I don't know what it's like to be out of that experience. So I can't help but be informed by it. And that's like, that's not a very helpful answer to your question, but it's the only answer that I feel like I can give.
Thank you.
It's a sensitive and really important question to address, but not in a forum like this.
Yeah.
All I would say is that not completely parallel, but the challenge of struggling between Medicare for All of Elizabeth Warren and fixing Obamacare, like Buttigieg and others want to do, is not unrelated to the question. It's like, how do we work in systems that need change? And do we say, it's not working, scrap it, build it anew? Or do we say, let's get a modest improvement, but feel disappointed that it's not perfect? And I don't know if it's completely parallel, but it's certainly not, it's not relevant to the question. In terms of identity, you know, like, you know that there's a book out on Rashi, and it turns out that Rashi is actually far more feminist than most of the other, Parshanim, or, you know, medievals that were interpreting. Because, and so, and the claim is he had three daughters. Then there was nobody else that had three daughters that had to actually write, you know, Parshanut. And so, The question is like on the table, and I think it's a really important one, is that there's this tension between queer identity and our reading. And every time I come to this question, I recognize that my queerness is impacting my reading, but so is the fact that my mother is a Holocaust survivor. And so is the fact that I grew up in the Midwest. And so is the fact that I'm a Baal Tshuva at the age of 15, that a Haredi guy like impacted and changed my life. And that I went to Gush Etzion and got totally inside Israel for a period of my life. Like, what isn't a piece of my interpretive? You understand? So to segment out as if I could my queerness from all that, I think it's just futile and silly. That doesn't mean that what I'm teaching, I hope, falls upon ears that are queer, that appreciate it and draw strength from it. I hope that's true. But it doesn't describe either the product or me perfectly. And so I think that's the, kind of one of the fallacies of identity politics, is that it actually overloads one characteristic of me, as opposed to like painting the whole picture in an interesting way, including this. So with that caveat, the answer is yes, it certainly impinges upon what I teach, what I choose to teach, what I find interesting, but not the only piece of the story.
Thank you. I want to take up the other question of what's next. Not that I know, but because I have a concern about it. So I'm going to try and articulate this. So when I came out, it was about 35 years ago, and being a lesbian was the cutting edge. It was radical. It was scary. It was edgy. And now it's the new normal. You know, every television program has to have its own lesbian. So on the one hand,
it's called gay blasé.
So on the one hand, you know, that has served me. It solved 9 years of immigration torture for my family, even though I've long been an advocate for not for dismantling marriage, I got married, So on the one hand, you know, it's given me things and it's given us as a community things, and I like that, and I want that to continue. And on the other hand, I get very nervous about it because I don't want to stop being on the edge, so I'm not sure what's next for our community. I want to know who the next invisible group is going to be, because we keep expanding, and I think that's fantastic. And I want to just keep an eye out for who needs us to speak up for them at this point. And I also want to keep us on the edge. And I'm not sure how to balance those two things of keeping us on the edge and yet advocating for our rights. So I feel like that's part of the holy Jewish work, is trying to figure that out.
Can I add one?
Please.
One thing? I'm trans. Hello, hi. And for a long time, when I was growing up, I looked at the rabbinate and I did not see anyone like me in it. And I wondered if there was a future in organized Jewish life, you know, even not even in the rabbinate, just like in Jewish life at all, for someone who is trans, to live openly and affirmatively the way I want to live. I'm very pleased that this now has changed and that there are out trans rabbis. We need more, which means, so where do we go from here? We need to expand accessibility of texts and education that is not available to people of particular backgrounds, people who are income limited, people who are who especially this is going to be a generational thing, have economic issues that prevent them from doing things like going to rabbinical school, or cantorial school, or whatever it is. We need to start creating alternative paths to Jewish leadership that are not dominated by a particular vision of what Jewish masculinity looks like, if that makes sense to what I'm trying to say. The images that I grew up with of what it meant to be a Jewish leader were invariably tied up with what it meant to be a Jewish man. And one of the, we've gone a long way towards dismantling that, but as a trans woman, I can tell you, I see an awful lot more trans masculine spectrum people in Jewish leadership, queer leadership, period, than with trans feminine spectrum people. Gee, I wonder why that could be. I see a lot of white people, white Jews. These issues intersect. They really do. We need to start dismantling that. And so the question to me, so where do we go from here, is we need to expand the idea of what it means to be a Jewish leader, like a sort of Jewish thought leader. When I was asked to be on this channel, I was identified as a thought leader in queer Judaism, and I was like, if you only knew how many of my thoughts were just like, you know, terrible internet memes, you wouldn't say that. But what I think what I'm trying to say is we need to be very expansive about what we mean by a thought leader. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone with rabbi in front of their name. And we need to make we need to make rabbi in front of people's names more accessible to people. So we need to do both. Does that make sense? That's where I think I want to go from here.
I want to thank each of our panelists so much. I have no doubt gained very specific bits of wisdom on ways to approach Torah and our text from each of you today. I know there's so much more that we could have learned from you. And I also think want to really close with the blessing that is coming from Rabbi Sarah Love's words of Kiddushim to you, that the work that we're doing today and the learning that's going to happen over the next few hours can push us further in our pursuit towards holiness. Holiness, both in holding, relating to the text with love and loyalty, while at the same time sort of demanding a perfection that we might sometimes not find there. So if we could give a round of gratitude and thanks to our panelists.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.